Welcome to the court. We have two cases today. The first one is United States versus Thomas. Major Rodriguez, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, sir.
Major Sawyer, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, then, please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. Appellant requests 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Contrary to Batson, the government reasoned it would make sense to have a black man on the panel because the government assumed a black man would vote to convict a white man accused of making racial slurs about black people, but didn't fit the government's stereotype of a black man because he said he would not automatically perceive racial slurs as unlawful. When he didn't act the way the government wanted him to, the government peremptorily challenged him, and in so doing, violated his independent constitutional right not to be excluded from the panel based on his race. In violation of Tulloch's heightened burden, none of the government's explanations were reasonably race-neutral. The military judge, influenced by an erroneous view of the law and without providing any analysis, erred by not fulfilling her ultimate responsibility to determine the existence of purposeful discrimination.
Counsel, if I may, I'd like to pose a hypothetical to you. Let's say that the accused is charged with assault, and the prospective panel member says in the course of the voir dire proceedings, "You know, I grew up in a rough part of town. Fistfights were common. Furthermore, when I was an adult, I was punched out of nowhere by a guy. But I'm philosophical about such things. I try to understand where the aggressor is coming from. I try to ignore such things, move on, because they don't have any effect on my profession." In that scenario, would the government, the trial counsel, have a proper basis to use the peremptory challenge to strike him from the panel?
I think in that scenario, Your Honor, they would have an easier time complying with Batson. It depends upon the facts of the case.
But why? You're talking about at the very beginning of the case is during the voir dire, and he's saying that with an accused being charged with assault, essentially, very philosophical, I've dealt with this, I can move on, doesn't affect me. Why wouldn't the trial counsel have an appropriate basis to say, essentially, that might make you an admirable human being, but I, as the government, don't want you on my panel?
In your hypo, Your Honor, there doesn't seem to be any racial stereotyping like there was going on here.
Why do you say there's racial stereotyping going on here?
The government, or the trial counsel, as revealed by his explanations when challenged by the defense, explains that, in essence, no, Your Honor, we're not basing our challenge on race because it would make sense for us to have a black panel member on the jury.
Now, did he say that? Because on page 19 of your own brief, you write, quote, "Trial counsel reasoned that it would make no sense for the prosecution to purposely exclude an African-American panel member in light of the alleged misconduct." You seem to be doing the opposite side of that coin and saying...
Correct, Your Honor. You're correct about what trial counsel actually said, but those words reveal the trial counsel's sort of base position, their baseline position, their starting position, is that without knowing anything specific about him, any of his qualities, anything about his temperament, that their starting position is that they want him on the panel, that it makes sense to have him.
Wait a minute. You've got a situation where as soon as he's challenged through Batson on this, the trial counsel is saying, It didn't have to do anything with race. Why would I exclude, in this case, an African-American panel member?
Why,
if he's simply citing, this makes no sense that I would exclude someone based on their race, in this case, how can that be turned against the trial counsel?
Because it reveals that the trial counsel is considering race. They're saying our starting position is that he would be on here, and the only reason they're saying that is based on a racial stereotype, that as a black man, he's preconceived to rule a certain way.
So by saying I am exercising my peremptory challenge for neutral reasons, it has nothing to do with race, you're saying the mere invocation of race feeds into the scenario where it was actually going through the mind of the trial counsel?
It's not just the mere invocation of race, Your Honor. It's the way that that explanation reveals the trial counsel's thought process, that race in and of itself is a factor on who we want sitting on this panel as sort of a neutral position.
Does Batson or any of our precedents say that we're supposed to crawl into the minds of people in the course of a Batson challenge, or is it a much more objective analysis in terms of what is the explanation that is offered by the trial counsel, and is that explanation valid?
The trial counsel's explanation is not the end of the inquiry. The trial counsel's explanation is merely step two in the Batson analysis. That even if the trial counsel's explanation is race-neutral under civilian standard, reasonably race-neutral under Tulloch's heightened burden, there still is the ultimate inquiry at step three of Batson, where the military judge needs to determine whether purposeful discrimination is occurring.
So, counsel, I'm curious. You keep calling that step three of Batson, but civilian courts don't do that step. So is that a Batson requirement, or is that a Moore or Tulloch requirement that this court has added on in addition to what Batson requires?
Your Honor, I believe that both civilian case law and military case law, Tulloch, Moore, like you mentioned, require all three steps of the analysis in a general sense. I mean, there ultimately has to be the ultimate inquiry is whether there's purposeful racial discrimination. So if at step two of the analysis the government hasn't met its burden, hasn't come forward with a race-neutral explanation under the civilian standard or a reasonably race-neutral explanation under the military standard, that can be the end of the Batson analysis. And under both systems, we would never get to that ultimate inquiry. But under both systems, if the government meets its burden at the second step, then the third step is required, I think, under both military and civilian law.
Also, you mentioned in your opening statement that you thought, I understand why you said that the military judge had a dearth of explanation, but you also said that that the military judge misunderstood the law. And what would you point to in the record that indicates that the military judge misunderstood the law?
Yes, Your Honor. I think a couple of points. On JA 36 and 37, after the defense has asked for after the defense has made its Batson challenge and asked for a race-neutral explanation, the government gives its first explanation. If you listen to the audio, you'll hear that there's a pause there. And then the military judge, without making any sort of findings, without engaging in any sort of analysis, without making any sort of ultimate determination, seems to move on from the Batson issue and ask defense, okay, do you have a peremptory challenge? So that's the first point where the record suggests that the military law may be influenced by an erroneous view of the law. Later on, after some back and forth, the military judge says, I've considered both sides, and I've determined that the government has offered a race-neutral explanation. So not quite invoking the language of Tulloch that the explanation need be reasonably race-neutral, it must make sense, it must not be implausible, and ends her analysis there and grants a peremptory challenge. So again, not making that, misrepresenting the Tulloch standard, and then not making the ultimate factual determination of discriminatory intent.
And does that ultimate factual determination have to be made on the record? Or can we infer from the way she ruled on the Batson challenge and the and allowing the peremptory challenge to go forward that she decided there was no racial discrimination?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant's not aware of any authority that says in every case the military judge must make that explicit third factual finding. However, looking at Tulloch, looking at Green from this court, especially in cases where the factual predicate is being disputed, this court's precedent strongly suggests that the military judge should make that factual finding in those cases and says that it's not an onerous burden on the judge.
So, Counselor, is it your argument then that the military judge should be afforded less deference in that she did not place her reasoning on the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
Major Rodriguez, let me offer, if I can, a hypothetical, maybe along the lines of the Chief Judge, but maybe with a twist. And here's what I'm wondering. Suppose you have a situation where the member, like the one in this case, in responding to voir dire questions, says, hey, look, I understand what kind of case this is. However, in my experiences as a person of color, I've seen way worse. I've been exposed to worse. I've been called worse. And it's not that I will be dismissive of the charges in this case, but I think I've learned to deal with this, and I can sit here, at least in my own life, I believe I can sit here as an impartial member in this case. And the trial counsel hears this and says, you know, as he thinks to himself, you know, this member doesn't, based on his experiences with race, doesn't appear to be as offended. He's not sufficiently offended by what the accused is alleged to have said or done in this case. And then the trial counsel puts that on the record, saying, Judge Rodriguez, I don't think this, I'm using you as the judge.
Appreciate it, Your Honor.
Judge Rodriguez, I don't believe that this member is sufficiently offended by what goes on here, based on his experiences as a person of color. And I want to peremptorily challenge this member. And I understand this is the only member of color on the panel, but that's our reasoning. Now, what about that situation? Do you believe that Batson is an absolutist principle? In other words, the principles in Batson and its progeny, they're absolutist in the fact that what I'm asking is, does simply the mere mention of race or hint at a racial issue or a racial background, does that invoke the principles of Batson? And would the military judge be in jeopardy for keeping such a member on the panel in violation of Batson? You know what I'm asking?
Yes, Your Honor.
No. Yeah.
Short answer is no. Batson is not that absolutist. The mere mention of race does not mean that a peremptory challenge can't survive.
Well, let me ask you this then. Where's the line between, in my hypothetical, of the trial counsel removing or wanting to remove the member based on race and based on some other reasoning that happens to be related to the racial background of the member?
The military judge in your hypo, Your Honor, would need to look at all the facts and circumstances, evidence, whether direct or circumstantial, to determine whether the trial counsel is substantially motivated by race. Where is the line? Is there a bright line rule that tells us how to go about that calculus? Appellant's not aware of authority that gives it.
So apparently your position then is, because of that, what you've just said, that it seems to place more importance on the military judge's obligation to place his or her reasoning on the record, because we may not fully understand what the reasoning of the trial counsel is. We can't get into anybody's minds in any of these
Correct.
Cases. Is that a fair assessment of where you are on this spectrum? I don't want to speak
yeah, and as an ultimate matter, no, we can't get inside trial counsel's mind. We can infer, we can make conclusions about what's on trial counsel's mind, what's motivating trial counsel based on what they say when challenged. And what they say can reveal purposeful racial discrimination, whether that discrimination is motivated by stereotype, whether that stereotype might be something that is a more favorable stereotype, something more benign. There's no requirement.
But in my hypothetical, let's assume there's no stereotyping going on. The trial counsel is genuinely, let's go farther. The trial counsel in my hypothetical is genuinely concerned that, hey, this member is not sufficiently offended by these allegations against the accused, and we don't know if he will be favorable to our side of the case.
Not to fight the hype, Your Honor, but I think that a black panel member not being sufficiently offended is itself playing on a racial stereotype. Take the trial.
Well, it might be a presumption, right? But is that right. A racial stereotype?
It seems like it was a presumption based on race, that because he's black, he must be offended to a sufficient level.
More than a white person, you would say? Is that the...
That's what it sounds like happening in your hypo. I mean, another way we can determine whether trial counsel is actually concerned about that is to look at what else the trial counsel does or does not do during voir dire. Is trial counsel probing other panel members about the same issue, ensuring that other panel members are sufficiently offended. To assume that a black member is the only one who's going to be sufficiently offended, I think plays on race.
Or should be more offended.
Or should be more offended, correct.
But where on the record is there any indication that, in fact, the other prospective panel members said the same thing as this prospective panel member?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you repeat the question?
Sure. You're talking now with Judge Sparks about how this plays out. What if you have a white prospective panel member who essentially says, yeah, I think people need to get over racial epithets and so forth. Presumably, trial counsel, who is looking for the conviction, would seek to exercise peremptory challenge to remove him or her from the panel. So why is this a problem in terms of if you're using the same reasoning for whether the prospective panel member is white or black, how is race an issue here under Batson?
Your Honor, I see that my time is up. May I
Please
answer?
Proceed.
In this case, none of that happened. I mean, there seemed to be very surface-level questioning by the trial counsel of the panel members, and I'm thinking of the two other panel members in particular who indicated they had been victims of racial offenses. And trial counsel merely asked in a broad way, what were those and can you be objective? There was no probing of either of those panel members of how offended are you, are you sufficiently offended, do you take action, do you not take action? So sort of that disparate questioning that occurred here where was a special focus, and the other panel members seemed to not get that same level of scrutiny, I think is circumstantial evidence of what trial counsel's intent was.
Judge Hardy.
I know you think there was a Batson error here, but I just want to be a little more specific. Do you think the military judge erred at what you call Batson Step 2 because there was really no racially neutral reason at Step 3 because she failed to put her reasoning on the record and it was sort of a technical error, or on Step 3 because on the merits she's just wrong about there being no racial discrimination motivating the challenge? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, there's various places along the steps where the military judge could have, and I'm just, other than just generally there being a Batson error, I wondered if you could articulate what is it specifically that you want the court to hold?
At I think there's no dispute that the first step of Batson was met. There's very low standard in the military justice system. It's in effect, if the other party objects, then the burden shifts to the government. In this case, when the burden shifted to the government, specifically the government didn't meet its heightened burden under Tulloch, under the military justice system, to offer a reasonably race-neutral explanation. But they offered some explanations. Some of those explanations such as his body language, his attitude, his personal resilience, don't, on their face, invoke race. And so perhaps the military judge was convinced by that, that just merely because they're not invoking race, that satisfies the second step. Tulloch doesn't support that position, so there's error there. And then as to the ultimate factual determination, there's no indication that the military judge knew that she had to make that determination. And so
Does she not get the benefit of the presumption that she knows the law?
There is a presumption that she knows the law unless there's evidence to the contrary here. And I think going back to my earlier answer of the three places where we've alleged she erred, I think that warrants her less deference in this case. And the ultimate, when she doesn't make the ultimate conclusion, it doesn't explain her analysis. I think this court is left to wonder, what did she base her decision on? Is it that she was convinced that they weren't purposely discriminating? Is it that their explanation or some of their explanations didn't on their face invoke race? Was she convinced when trial counsel ultimately says, oh, body language, personal resilience? We don't know because the military judge didn't put any of that on the record.
Please, Judge Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief. Counsel, how would U.S. v. Green factor into your analysis, the Green holding being that an explanation which includes in part a reason, criteria, or basis that patently demonstrates an inherent discriminatory intent? It seems that and it cannot reasonably be deemed neutral. So is that where are you hanging your hat on part of the military justice error or her misunderstanding of the law is that she would have to have concluded that all four of the reasons or rationale that trial counsel provided were racially neutral? And because we have no analysis, right, we don't know what is it she actually was doing. Okay.
If any one of the I assume Your Honor is making reference to the dissenting opinion at ACCA where he breaks trial counsel's explanation down into four reasons. Per Green, if any one of those four as offered as a justification by the government, if any one of those four is motivated by purposeful racial discrimination, then appellant would prevail.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Rodriguez. Major Sawyer.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Mark Sawyer, and along with Captain Alex Burkham, represent the United States. This court should affirm the court-martial and hold that the military judge did not abuse her discretion when she rejected the defense Batson challenge. The prosecutor provided a reasonable, racially neutral explanation in response to the defense Batson challenge, and the judge did not find discriminatory intent. This court gives the military judge great deference in that decision. Second, even if this court finds that explanation implausible or unreasonable, it was racially neutral. This court should revisit its holding in United States v. Tulloch, align the military practice with the Supreme Court precedent, and uphold this case. I wanted to start, Your Honor, by just discussing what I think is the fundamental error in the defense argument, which is they apply a racially discriminatory intent from the moment showed up in court. That way, they can apply a racially discriminatory intent when he left. The defense argument today is looking into his head the prosecutor's head and attempting to determine what they were thinking from the moment that panel member sat down in court. The person who is best situated to make those determinations on what the prosecutor was thinking and what was going on in court is the military judge.
But the military judge didn't put that on the record. So let me ask you at the outset here, is step three required under Tulloch or anything else?
I think the court will give the military judge less deference when she doesn't specifically say, I don't find discriminatory intent.
However, how much less?
Somewhere between that. If she actually said those words, Your Honor, it would be a clearly erroneous finding, but we're not at de novo review. The military judge certainly listened to the prosecutor's arguments. She said, I find the arguments racially neutral, and then she moved on. On top of that, even if this court made a de novo review, looking at the prosecutor's arguments, we don't have a racial bias in what he's saying.
Well, wait a minute. Let's step back and look at what the record is before us based on what the military judge said or did not say. She didn't cite the applicable law, did she?
She did not, Your Honor.
And did she put any findings of fact on the record?
She did not, Your Honor.
So she just came up with a conclusory, in a conclusory fashion, okay, you're off the panel. Could there be more of a conclusory approach than that? And so why should we give any deference at all?
Well, Your Honor, the way the defense is arguing this case, where they're trying to get inside the prosecutor's head, is exactly what we're relying on the judge to do. The Supreme Court has said that the district judges, the trial court judges, are the ones who are best positioned to defend the 14th Amendment and to ensure that prosecutors are not acting with discriminatory.
So accepting that, what I'm asking, though, is the issue of deference. When a military judge doesn't go through any of that to acknowledge what their important responsibility is in this regard and simply essentially says, move on, why are we granting any deference at that point?
Because we were not in the courtroom, Your Honor, and we were not there to observe what was going on between the prosecutor and the panel members. What I would say is even if this court does go to a de novo level of review, we still have a racially neutral explanation. The trial counsel's concern, which was raised by both your and Judge Sparks' hypos to the defense, was how would this panel member treat victims of these types of crimes. And in fact, towards the end of his summation to the military judge, he specified that, and this is from JA 38, would not consider these crimes, things like cruelty and maltreatment, as seriously as another panel member would. And if we look at the charge sheet, we know that the defendant was charged with was more than just using racist language against individuals. It was also language against women. It was also language against Muslims. So the trial counsel's concerns here are broader than just, does he think the specific language used was objectionable, which would also be a racially neutral explanation, but he's looking more broadly at how this panel member was dealing with cruelty and maltreatment and these types of crimes, which don't necessarily have a physical impact on the victim, but certainly may have a psychological impact. So looking simply at the trial counsel's words to the judge and in the court, we have a reasonable race-neutral explanation, and there's no need to really delve any further.
But, counsel, how can we – what are we then to make of this, the opening statement of trial counsel? And the chief judge read it, and I lost my tab. But, you know, it makes no sense for the government to want to exclude an African-American from this panel. I mean, that's invoking race right there. So are you not counting that as one of his part of his rationale?
Your Honor, as we went over in our brief, what I think the government was saying there, the prosecutor was saying there, was it was more of a – he was surprised that the defense made the Batson challenge because he didn't have any racial animus as he was striking that panel member. It also certainly shows, as the defense counsel pointed out directly after the prosecutor made that statement, that he didn't necessarily have a good understanding of how Batson worked. But what it doesn't show
You lost me on the pronoun. Who didn't have a good understanding?
The prosecutor, Your Honor.
Okay.
The trial counsel. What it does not show, though, is actual discriminatory intent. It's more of his surprise and perhaps his lack of knowledge of exactly how the Batson challenge worked, but he reverted back then to his original explanation. This is a panel member who's not going to take these crimes as seriously, that being the discriminatory language used against Muslims, women, and African-American individuals, and therefore the prosecutor does not want him on the panel.
Major Sawyer, could I just kind of piggyback off of Judge Johnson's question? Regarding the statement that trial counsel made about why would we, it would not be in our interest or whatever the language is to remove the only black member of the panel, what does the fact, in looking at that statement, what does the fact that the member is a person of color or is black, what does that have to do with his explanation of why he thinks the member should be preempted? You know, in other words, why did he have to say that? I mean, why, what relevance would that have to his position of why this member needs to be removed?
Your Honor, I think it has zero relevance. Again, I think what the prosecutor was expressing was a surprise at the Batson challenge. He had not considered his peremptory challenge a racially motivated challenge, and certainly a misunderstanding about how it works, but I don't think it shows.
Yeah, but shouldn't he have said what you just said? I know you weren't there, but what you just said makes more sense than what he said.
I don't necessarily think everything that comes out of someone's mouth at court is perfectly scripted, Your Honor.
I understand.
I think we can give the trial counsel some grace there when he was providing a racially neutral explanation, and then he continued to provide racially neutral explanation all the way through the colloquy with the military judge and the defense counsel.
Mm-hmm.
We simply don't have a trial counsel like in Green where his explanation was so racially tied to the panel member's background that there's no way that he wasn't considering that. Here,
mm-hmm.
there's an offhand comment about, well, this clearly shows a misunderstanding of how Batson works, but doesn't show any type of discriminatory intent.
Mm-hmm.
But, counsel, then going back to appellant's argument about looking at the totality of the circumstances and trying to assess whether there is a discriminatory intent, we must also then look at how trial counsel handled the other two members of color who were potential panel members, one of which, as I recall, had a much more visceral type of answer of the tantamount to, yeah, it pisses me off when I hear, you know, racial epithets or whatever, and yet trial counsel did not follow up on that. So how are we to reconcile that trial counsel may not have had, good or bad, a discriminatory intent in striking
Yes, Your Honor. So the two panel members were situation was something like 30 some years ago. He agreed that he was offended, but it wasn't really affecting him anymore. Had not actually been directly the recipient of racial epithets, but he did say, I think, believe the word on page 134 is charged, was the way he described
it. Charged. He gets
his
charged.
When he hears that. Mm-hmm. Sorry for talking over you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Provided the most explanation of all of the members when.
But isn't that because there were follow up questions posed to him that were not posed to the other two?
A lot of the follow up questions, from Your Honor, if I recall, came from the defense counsel. But he also provided initially far more explanation on what was going on. The trial counsel's voir dire begins on JA-24, provides a relatively lengthy explanation about growing up in Germany in a town with a large neo-Nazi organization, and then talks about issues when he was at Fort Polk when people would ask his co-workers what it was like to live with a black man using a racial epithet. The trial counsel asked him to describe the instances. He describes it briefly and then says, I just don't categorize. And then the trial counsel goes into additional questions, mainly concerning whether or not they could work together. And a follow-on question about when he was a company commander and dealt with an investigation on racial discrimination. So it's not necessarily that he was questioning this member harder, but this member provided a lot more material that the trial counsel then had to go into to discuss. It's like he had the racial discrimination as a kid, he had the racial discrimination at Fort Polk, and he, as a company commander, he dealt with an investigation on racial discrimination. Each one of those deserved a follow-on question, whereas talked about the fact that he was subject to a racial epithet I think it was 32 years prior, mm-hmm. but didn't describe anything in his current life or any issues that he's currently having, and had a comment about being charged, but was never actually the victim of racial discrimination. And those are major differences, and some of them require additional inquiry by the trial counsel or the defense counsel. But a lot of the additional inquiry on actually came from the defense counsel following his inquiry at the trial counsel. We have 134 through 137 with the defense counsel.
Sorry, okay, Kate. I don't want to. You can get back into your argument. I got it. Thanks.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like now to turn to the second part of my argument, Your Honor, which is what happens if this court finds that this explanation, even if race neutral, is unreasonable or under Tulloch. And this court should still affirm the case because it should revisit its holding in Tulloch, which departed from the Supreme Court precedent. The court is only free to depart from the Supreme Court precedent in matters of constitutional law when there is a legitimate military necessity or distinction. Batson and its progeny, if you look at the history there, it comes from a historical discrimination against minorities on jury service. As the dissent noted in Tulloch, at least post the Civil Rights era and perhaps even post the enactment of the UCMJ, we don't have a record of the systematic discrimination in the military that was occurring on jury selection
in
the civilian system.
But Moore and Tulloch, doesn't that whole line of cases come because we have a very different system, at least currently, for picking panel members than they have in the civilian world for picking juries, right? There's no requirement. You just have to be alive and be a citizen and be on the rolls to be a jury member, right? But in the military, the convening authority picks those best qualified to serve, right? So I thought those line of cases they're not trying to put a gloss on Batson so much as they're enforcing a different set of rules because of the different manner in which we pick panels rather than juries.
Absolutely, Your Honor. However, the way that the panel selection has changed over the past 30 years certainly suggests perhaps a relook at Tulloch from this court. Not that long ago, when I was practicing court, the convening authority would select 10 to 15 members. They would show up in court. They were numbered in priority, and it was the same members every single time. And they would sit unless they were challenged for cause or they were preempted off the panel. So those 15 people that showed up, all 15 may sit, 10 may sit, and a general court-martial, no less than 5 would sit. There would be excusals. Different people would come in. But in general, over the course of a year, the trial counsel and the defense counsel were going to see the same members over and over again. They were the best qualified as literally numbered by the CG, and there was a familiarity with the members as a consul was practicing that you would not have in a civilian system. The changes that Congress has done to the UCMJ and the changes that have also come enacted through the RCMs have brought the military system closer to a civilian system, even though Article 25 criteria certainly still stand and the CG still selects members. But in contrast to the 10 or 15 same people showing up each time, the convening authority will pick from a large selection of members depending on the size of the jurisdiction. The trial counsel sends those to the military judge. I believe I'm not going to say the RCM right now. And the numbers are going to be randomized, and they're going to show up. However many show up, potentially 15, maybe less, maybe more, on a general court-martial, eight will sit. And on a special court-martial, 4 will sit.
Counsel, I have a slightly different question. If we assume it's true that Tulloch and this court, through Tulloch and those cases, has put an additional burden on the military justice system that doesn't exist in the civilian world, if you have a Tulloch error, I'll call it that, that would not be a Batson error, what kind of error is it? Is that a structural error? And really what I'm going to get at is what are the potential remedies for a Tulloch error as opposed to a Batson error? I think the Supreme Court has told us Batson errors are structural errors. We know what we have to do when there's a Batson error. What do we do when there's a Tulloch error?
Your Honor, I think the way this Court's precedent currently reads is it would be a structural error. We would send the court-martial back for a new hearing.
And what's the justification for that? If it's not a constitutional requirement, if this is an additional requirement that this court has imposed on the military justice system, what's the justification for labeling it a structural error?
Your Honor, I believe this court has interpreted it as a constitutional issue. It's the way they have applied the 14th Amendment to the military panel selection process. I think that the issue here, which is that by doing it this way, you don't necessarily have cases of intentional discrimination that are still getting reversed based off of this heightened standard under Tulloch. And I think that's what comes to the meat of what the government is arguing, which is this standard, this court should relook this standard, considering whether or not there is a history of purposeful discrimination on peremptory strikes, but also looking at the way the military justice system has changed over the past decade, really, and whether or not the arguments that the majority made in Tulloch still stand true today. Or are we in a situation now where we are departing from Supreme Court precedent, which we're not free to do unless we have a legitimate military necessity or distinction? And that doesn't really exist anymore, other than, as I've acknowledged, the Article 25 criteria as opposed to the random selection from voter rolls or however else the local authorities may draw their panel members or jury members. Pending any questions from this court should find no discrimination in the prosecutor's use of a peremptory strike against and affirm the case.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Sawyer. Major Rodriguez.
To touch on Tulloch, we concur that it is a constitutional error. The government hasn't offered any persuasive reason to revisit Tulloch, no evidence that it's unworkable. The differences between the civilian system and the military justice system are still there, as acknowledged by the government. And this court and the military justice system are still grappling with issues of race. We had, I believe, Ramirez during the last session or the last term, and before that, Jeter. Switching to government's argument that the trial counsel didn't seem to be motivated by racial animus in explaining why he struck me. Appellant wants to make clear that Batson doesn't require that the racial consideration be motivated by animus. Whether the racial stereotyping is bad, a black member is not fit to serve on this panel, or whether that racial stereotyping is good, see Jeter, we need black panel members in order to make the panel more representative of the service. This court has held that either are not proper. You asked, Judge Hardy, is step three required? The short answer is yes. We need not get to step three in every Batson challenge if the government hasn't met its burden at step two. But Batson is all about determining whether there is purposeful racial discrimination. There have been cases where the military judge didn't explicitly make that finding, and this court has held that, well, we can determine that she's impliedly made that finding. But those were in cases where the factual predicate wasn't challenged by defense. And in this case, we had that challenge. And in terms of the deference that should be given to the military judge, the military judge's decision that there was no Batson violation should be given some deference, but no other deference beyond that based on her lack of findings and analysis. Pending your questions.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Rodriguez. Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:25.